evil face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, arr, gar, gar. Pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for not, or no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish it didn't get.
Pirate radio, arr, gar, gar.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Bukitas, who plays a sour note. W is tie is this, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.immnc.org, for Wednesday, July 27, 2011. Israeli troops kidnap peace activists in Bethlehem and demand villagers of Al-Araqib to pay for the demolition of their homes. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Two Palestinian and four Israeli activists were kidnapped outside Al-Walaja village Wednesday morning while protesting the bulldozing of an olive tree grove. The Israeli army blocked everyone from access to the olive grove, which is being uprooted. Among those kidnapped are Al-Walaja resident Shireen Al-Araj and human rights activist Dr. Mazen Qumsi. International Israeli and Palestinian activists have been protesting Israeli attempts to uproot olive trees outside of Al-Walaja village. Dr. Qumsiyah told IMEMC over the phone that troops rushed at him, pushed him on the floor, handcuffed and blindfolded, and took him away. He showed no resistance to the arrest. In occupied East Jerusalem, the Al-Aqsa Foundation in Jerusalem published a video showing members of Israeli undercover forces attacking Palestinian children as they played in the alleys. The video clearly shows the vehicle approaching the children and its passenger kidnap Islam Jaber, 13, from Jerusalem. The foundation also said the child was taken to a nearby graveyard where he was beaten by the soldiers. In a separate incident, another special force of the Israeli army attacked the Freedom Theater in the West Bank city of Jenin early Wednesday morning. Masked soldiers threw stone blocks at windows, kidnapped several staff, and threatened others at gunpoint. Adnan Naghnaghiya, the location manager, and Bilal Saadi, a member of the board, were both kidnapped by the Israeli soldiers and were taken to unknown location. When Jacob Goff, the general manager, and Yonatan Stangzak, the co-founder of the theater, arrived, they were forced at gunpoint to squat on the floor with the family who had among them four children. Stangzak stated, quote, "Whenever we tried to tell them that they are attacking a cultural venue and arresting members of the theater, we were told to shut up, and they threatened to kick us. I tried to contact the civil administration of the army to clarify the matter, but the person in charge hung up on me, end quote. Last April, Giuliano Mirhamis, general director of the Freedom Theater, was murdered by unidentified assailants. In other news, Israel has filed suits against 34 Bedouins from Al-Araqib for costs incurred while repeatedly demolishing their homes. The state is seeking an unprecedented $530,000 from the group. The Israeli Land Administration claims that the Bedouins repeatedly build homes on state-owned land despite having houses some distance away, Haaretz News reports. The ILA, who defined the people of Al-Araqib as squatters, claims that land was leased to the Bedouins until 1998. However, the state took action to evict the residents starting in 1999. Israeli authorities have demolished the houses of Al-Araqib villagers for more than 20 times, and the villagers continue to rebuild them. That rounds up the main news for today. Please join us again tomorrow for a summary of important events in the Palestinian territories. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, George Rishmael.
On the 24th of July, five pastors from the U.S. boat to Gaza, the Audacity of Hope, held a report back at Bus Boys and Poets, recounting the successes and the failures of Freedom Flotilla 2. Freedom Flotilla 2 was a 10-boat flotilla to Gaza, occupied Palestine, aimed at breaking Israel's siege of Gaza. Only one boat got past the blockade of Greek ports the Greek Coast Guard imposed in return for the IMF bailout. That was the French boat Dignity, which was attacked in international waters by the Israeli Navy, which, since there is no declared state of war between Israel and France, is either an act of piracy against a ship in international waters or an act of war by Israel against France, depending on whether or not the Israeli government takes responsibility for the attack. Here's what passengers from the U.S. boat, the Audacity of Hope, which was forcibly returned to a Greek port by the U.S. Coast Guard, had to say at Bus Boys and Poets. We begin with Medea Benjamin's accounting of the events of the flotilla.
We were going to start moving our boats, but suddenly there was something called a complaint that was put against our boat. And that meant that somebody somewhere had said that our boat was not seaworthy, and they were worried about us going out on these boats. Well, it didn't take long for somebody to uncover that the person or the entity that lodged the complaint was none other than this right-wing Israeli law center based in Tel Aviv that knew nothing about our boat and certainly had no interest in the passenger safety. But it turns out that the Greeks took that as a reason to then say that our boat did not have authorization to set sail. So we went to meet with representatives of the U.S. government to ask them for our help. Now, do you think the U.S. government did anything to help us?
Would they?
Hell no. That's right. Nothing at all. So we started to protest in front of the U.S. embassy, which didn't do us any good either, but it was an important place to protest. And then we decided that with or without this authorization to leave, we kept waiting every day to try to fix whatever they said was wrong until we realized that we would never fix it, that their idea was to have us never leave. And so we decided to try to set sail on our own without that authorization. And it was a great moment. You can see a kind of euphoria that we had that lasted for about how long?
Someone said about 20 minutes.
So as we're out, we suddenly see the Greek Coast Guard coming alongside of us. And we were all prepared, of course, to confront the Israeli Navy. We were not prepared to confront the Greek Coast Guard. And what was really interesting is the Greek Coast Guard, this was the captain of the Coast Guard ship that came along, and he seemed like a really sweet guy. And he kept urging us. He said, I beg you, please turn back. there was this ongoing conversation between our captain and the captain of the Greek Coast Guard. And basically, the Greek Coast Guard captain, he said, I have nothing against your mission, which we took as meaning, I actually support your mission. Then he would say, but, you know, you are not seaworthy. And our captain would say, well, we are seaworthy. We're in the sea. And our captain said, it is raw. What we're afraid of is actually being on the dock because the boats are getting sabotaged on the docks. And so for our own safety, we have to be out in the sea. And the captain would say, no, no, please, turn around and go back, please. And he would start reading from this list of complaints that we never received, but he had. And one of them, he said, you can't be out on the sea. You don't have air conditioning. Which made us all chuckle, because one, we did have air conditioning, but it's like saying, you know, you don't have Perrier water. That went on for about 2 hours until they finally brought in the heavy, the bad cops. And these were the commandos. They came on the small ships. And these ones were not into talking to us as the other captain was about how he wanted to get home to have dinner with his wife. These guys were a lot more serious. And at this point, our captain decided that it was time to turn around. So we turned around and were taken back into port, at which point our boat was being held in a military dock and our captain was taken off to jail. Do you think that the U.S. Embassy sent somebody to try to get our captain out of jail?
No way!
Hell no! No way! So some of us started a hunger strike. We began the hunger strike in front of the U.S. Embassy, pleading with them to do something. Instead of doing something to help the captain, what they did is have us arrested for merely sitting outside the embassy quietly doing a hunger strike. That's what our government is good for. But the Greeks who were there supporting us came down to show by the hundreds to show their support for the hunger strikers. And it was a beautiful moment.
Ray McGovern had a source inside the State Department that brought intelligence that the U.S. State Department didn't even care if U.S. citizens on the boats were killed.
And the person who told me had it from him directly. The thrust of what he said was, if these activists, if they think that the White House is going to protect them from an Israeli attack or an Israeli boarding, forget it. The White House officials, quote, would be happy if something happened to us. They are, quote, perfectly willing to have the cold corpses of activists shown on American TV.
Ooh.
Wow.
I'm sure it's
now,
true.
I wouldn't write that if I weren't sure of the sourcing, okay? Now, my friend, former UK Ambassador Craig Murray, who quit the Foreign Service when he found that the Foreign Service was condoning torture in Uzbekistan. He read what I wrote, and he's very kind and very diplomatic still. And he said, and I quote, I know Ray is an extremely honest man, but I thought it was possible that maybe his source was exaggerating. Pretty diplomatic. In other words, Craig Murray thought this was up over the top, but he said, Ray, you get too scared here. I therefore, said Craig, set out my own diplomatic sources to work in Washington without giving them any indication of Ray's information. They came back with an independent report from a different source, very close to Hillary Clinton, not the White House, with exactly the same result of which Ray was warned. So, that was the setting in which we took off for Athens and got on the boat. We were told by Hillary Clinton quite explicitly, she told the whole world, that if we got in trouble, in view of what happened last year, and it was very interesting, you know, Hillary Clinton and the others always used the passive voice when they described what happened last year. The boat was boarded, the people were killed, people were wounded, there was mayhem, but there was always a passive voice. You never heard who did this mayhem, okay? It was really quite bizarre. In any case, Hillary pretty much made it clear that if something happened to us, it was your own fault. You were warned, you know, you're going to be boarded.
State Department or not, with 11 people from the mainstream press on board, including the New York Times, they did have one deterrent against Israeli shooting.
11 people. Were they going to shoot up the New York Times folks, or the CNN folks? And so they were in a dilemma. And how did they solve it? Well, they leaned all over the Greeks. The Greeks are in economic crisis. The Greeks need to get another bailout. And so our diplomats, including our ambassador there in Athens, said, look, you need another bailout. You think you get another bailout? You let these characters, these activists, sail into the Israeli blockade. You better think this over. And so Papandreou tucked tail and relented and kept us from going.
Oh, isn't that an interesting and extraordinarily ugly development? The Greek government kept Freedom Flotilla 2 in port explicitly in return for United States, European, and no doubt IMF support for their austerity program and bailout, a program opposed by three-quarters of the Greek public, a program that has led to rioting in the streets and a continuous occupation of a public square in Athens, the sort of things we should have done here in the U.S. about TARP. That brings up the issue of international labor solidarity, and if Israel wants to impose a blockade on Palestine, well, it just so happens that dock workers and people working around ships can impose a counter-blockade on Israel by refusing to load and unload Israeli ships. Here's what an organizer from the IWW who was a passenger on the Audacity of Hope had to say about that.
In early June of last year, Palestinian labor organizations got together and issued a call for port workers of the world to essentially reverse the blockade that Israel has imposed upon Gaza by refusing to unload Israeli ships when they dock in whatever country internationally. And that call was responded to. Just a few weeks later, on June 20th of last year, the International Longshoremen Union of Local 10 of Oakland, California, held a one-day, 24-hour strike when the Zim, it's a big Israeli shipping company, came in to port. They refused to unload the boat. And 800 activists showed up. 800 people showed up in support. And there were a series of other responses around the world. Australian port workers, Sweden, South Africa, which of course has the historic connection with the anti-apartheid struggle, and they did not hesitate to make that connection. And India, the port workers refused to unload Israeli boats. These actions have so far been symbolic, 24 hours or what have you, but the great thing about labor solidarity is that there is potentially great power there. It could be crippling economically for Israel.
You heard that, Israel. And I know you can hear this at the Israeli embassy. Siege warfare is a game that two can play. And if workers won't unload ships, we don't even need weapons. Lift the siege of Gaza or face a siege yourselves. This has been WSQT Direct Action Radio coverage of the report back at Bus Boys and Poets on the 24th of July by five passengers from the U.S. boat to Gaza that was part of Freedom Flotilla 2. Afghanistan. Yesterday, the Italian military is reporting the death of an Italian soldier from an insurgent attack northwest of the Balamurgham Valley, Herat Province, Afghanistan. Two additional soldiers were wounded in the attack. Kandahar, Afghanistan today. The mayor of Kandahar, Ghulam Haidar, was killed in a suicide bomb attack at a city hall meeting, the latest in a series of recent high-profile assassinations the Taliban has taken credit for. Afghanistan, yesterday, a NATO helicopter crashed in the restive east of Afghanistan, and foreign troops battled an insurgent attack during a rescue operation, the so-called coalition reported. NATO's International Security Assistance Force said the crew and passengers received minor injuries in the incident. A police official said the helicopter appeared to have been downed by a rocket-propelled grenade. What do you want to put that with a tail rotor shot like Black Hawk Down? Afghanistan, yesterday, NATO forces in Afghanistan admitted that one of their attack helicopters had accidentally wounded five children in the southern province of Helmand. Afghanistan, yesterday, militants injured two security forces in a grenade attack Monday on a major NATO airbase at the airport in Jalalabad, the local police chief reported. Pakistan, Saturday, two NATO helicopter gunships violated Pakistan's border in the area of Kurram Agency. The gunships came 8 kilometers across the border into Pakistani airspace. The two helicopters remained in Pakistani airspace for some time with no sanction or authorization, and after making flights on different areas of Kurram Agency close to the Afghan border, returned to their airbase in Afghanistan. This was reported by private TV. Baghdad, Iraq, yesterday. A roadside bomb rocked Baghdad late on Monday, wounding 3 civilians. A police source told China's Xinhua news agency that the explosion took place on Abu Nuwas Street, and no further details can be obtained so far. In Syria, Iraq, today. 6 Katyusha rockets were fired at Ali Air Base used by U.S. forces, but losses were not known, a Dhikar security source reported. Basra, Iraq, reported today. A bomb exploded against a U.S. convoy in the north of Basra, police sources said here today. Basra, Iraq, Sunday. Another roadside bomb hit another U.S. Army patrol Sunday night, but losses were not known. Quote, an American patrol heading for Shuiba, 35 kilometers to the west of Basra, has become target for an explosive charge on its road, but results were not known, a police source told Aswat al-Iraq News Agency. Wait a minute. What U.S. patrol? What roadside bomb? I thought U.S. combat operations in Iraq were over. Oh, yeah. That's been said before. Mr. Barack Obama, now is the time to pull the plug on 8 and 10 years of useless war. If the U.S. government is talking about not being able to pay out all those Social Security checks on the 2nd of August, how can you afford to run 2 wars? Bring all the troops home today.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com.
On July 20th, two activists climbed 80 feet high in 2 trees adjacent to an active mountaintop removal coal mining site at Coal River Mountain in southern West Virginia. The site was owned by Massey Energy, the largest mountaintop removal coal miner in Appalachia, which also owns the underground Upper Big Branch mine, where 29 miners were killed last year. The company was sold this spring to Alpha Natural Resources, which is continuing the same operations. Junior Walk is a 21-year-old native of southern West Virginia who provided support to Catherine Ann McDougall, one of the tree sitters, along with Eli Shule, who served as the support person for the second tree sitter, Bex Collins. The two support persons were arrested by state police on the first day of the tree sit protest and charged with trespassing. The tree sit continues as of production time. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Walk about his decision to participate in this nonviolent civil disobedience action, which is one of a growing number of similar protests organized to stop mountaintop removal coal mining. He also discusses the goals of the sponsoring organization, Radical Action for Mountain People's Survival, or RAMPS, campaign. The group's acronym, RAMPS, references the wild onion that local residents used to harvest on the Appalachian Mountains, now threatened or destroyed by mountaintop removal coal mining.
After I graduated high school, I tried to go to college, but I was the first person in my family to graduate high school, let alone, you know, want to go to college, so I was stuck here because I didn't really have the means to go. And I did what everybody else does whenever they are stuck here. I went to work for Massey, right alongside my dad at the Elk Run Prep Plant, and he still works there today. That was just a terrible experience. I only worked there for about 6 months. Some days they would just have me, you know, cutting the grass or what have you. Some days I'd be walking the belt line or things like that. But it was just like I always felt like that lump of coal was worth more than what my life was worth. And I should prioritize the production over anything else. And I just couldn't live like that. So after that, I went around from job to job for a while until a friend of the family offered me a job as a security guard on a strip mine. And I took it, you know. I was like, oh, I get to sit around for 12 hours a night and make money. But when I got up there and I seen that, and I was in the middle of that, and I seen the way they were doing, and, you know, I seen them destroying that mountain. And I knew the people down below that mountain were going through the same stuff that I was going through when I was a kid, you know. Poison water, you know, poison air. You can't even go up on the mountain anymore, mostly because it don't exist, but also because there's gates up, you know, everywhere. You know, people don't have access to the places where their, you know, parents and grandparents, you know, hunted or gathered herbs and things like that. So I came to Coal River Mountain Watch, and I'd known Judy Bonds ever since I was a kid. She used to work at the store with my grandma, and I asked her how I could help, how I could plug in, how I could do something to alleviate my conscience, because I just felt like the most terrible human being making money off of what was going on and what was happening to those people below that mountain. I started, like, writing anonymously for the newsletter and, you know, things that I didn't have to put my name or face out there. And eventually Judy offered me a job. Well, it was Judy and Vernon, the two folks. Well, Vernon's still director of Coal River Mountain Watch, along with Debbie Gerald, and Judy Bonds passed away this past January of lung cancer. Ever since then, I've been here doing this sort of work, and it's frustrating going up against this Goliath that's the coal industry that controls this state completely. You know, our regulatory agencies won't help us because they're funded by the state, who is funded by the coal industry. And it's everything. Every place you can think of to turn to in the state government here is just, they won't listen to you if you say one ill word about coal or any sort of natural resource extraction. So I decided on my own that legal channels weren't enough to put a stop to what's going on here. That's why I decided to take this stand and try and do whatever I could to protect the community that I come from.
Exactly where are the two tree sitters?
They are in Beetree Holler, which is right next to the Beetree surface mine permit, and where active blasting has been going on. By sitting there as close as they are to the Beetree permit, they cannot blast on a certain section of the permit that they were working on before, and they can't get the coal that was right there.
And Junior Walk, what was your role, and why were you arrested?
I was direct support, which means that I helped get the tree sit up in the trees. You know, I helped haul the water and things and the platform up. And then we waited around for about 4 or 5 hours. They couldn't find us, and they had the entire site shut down for 5 hours because they didn't know where we were. And we eventually seen a helicopter buzzing us overhead, so we figured that that was the police. So we came out, me and Eli did, and it actually turns out it was Alpha executives that were actually flying dangerously close to the tree sitters.
I guess how long they stay up there depends on how long those supplies last, and especially on how aggressive the police are in getting them down. What is RAMPS campaign's goal in doing these kinds of actions?
Well, there are quite a few goals, actually. I mean, the first one we're accomplishing right now. They're not blasting where they were blasting before. And that's really the main goal. The other goal is to raise awareness about this issue on a national scale. And I think that we're accomplishing that quite well. And then the other goal is to inspire the people that live around here and make them remember that they have a choice. You know, they don't have to be afraid of the coal industry. They can stand up and tell the industry that they're not going to take the abuse anymore. And I've had, you know, numerous phone calls from people that knew me while I was growing up, you know, older people and things like that, that have told me if they were able-bodied or if they didn't have to live in fear of losing their only means of income, then they would have been right there with us.
That was Junior Walk, a local West Virginia activist acting in support of a tree-sitting protest at Coal River Mountain. Learn more about the opponents of mountaintop removal coal mining at our website at btlonline.org.
On the 20th of July, in a blasting, climate change-driven heat wave, two pro-Earth activists from a campaign called Ramps climbed into platforms and trees 80 feet off the ground near the Bee Tree Mountaintop Removal Coal Mine in West Virginia. They are inside the 300-foot safety zone required for blasting operations, thus forcing the mine to shut down blasting entirely.
It used to be the most beautiful place in the world, and now it's just, it's hell on earth, you know.
When we demand that they stop stripping Coal River Mountain, we mean it.
So blasting is important to stop because it's the first step in the mining process.
The reason that people are dying in such large numbers is because people are being poisoned, and there are no other explanations for it.
Because I'm getting ready to help some good friends of mine haul their shells up in a tree to halt blasting on Coal River Mountain. I grew up, you know, on that mountain, pretty much. Born and raised, you know, downstream from the Brushy Fork impoundment.
Yeah, it's been something for me that was not foreseen when I first, when Junior and I had been talking about doing this. He wasn't, maybe he was sick, but he didn't know what was up. And then just to see, you know, he's young. I mean, he's 21 years old. It's not like he's been living here for 80 years and is sick. He's been here for 21 years and is like throwing up blood. That's something that you're not supposed to do. You know, that's not something that just like happens.
Cheap electricity is not worth the sacrifice that's being made here in Appalachia.
I'm realizing, I think, more and more that it is a dangerous thing to take, but what the coal industry is doing here is infinitely more dangerous, and I think the risks that we're taking need to be taken to end what is being done here.
No one ever knew there was coal in their mountains till a man from the northeast arrived. He was waving them $100 bills. He said, "Hey, I'll pay you for your minerals." But he never left Harlan alive.
Here are some longer interviews with the tree sitters in West Virginia who have shut down the Bee Tree Mountaintop Removal Coal Mine, pulled from a video published on the 26th of July.
Coal River Mountain is the last partially intact mountain in the Coal River watershed. You know, they have already tore apart almost every other mountain in this watershed to drag out the coal. I grew up, you know, on that mountain, pretty much. You know, gathering wild edibles and roots and, you know, going hunting.
I mean, these mountains are so biodiverse. There's mixed mesophytic forests, have just a wealth of biodiversity of herbs, like up in the forest up there. This spring, I saw so many spring ephemerals. There are ramps, there's bloodroot, there's black and blue cohosh, like every kind of medicinal herb, spring ephemeral you can think of. These are the richest, like biodiversity-wise, these are the richest temperate freshwater ecosystems in the world. And these mountains have been around for 500 million years. I mean, mountaintop removal is irreversible. There's no way, of course, that they can put the topography back in place, but it goes far, far beyond that. The topsoil that takes hundreds of years to build, reclamation isn't going to fix that. They're not going to be able to put back a stream. When they create these drainages with rocks in them, there's none of the components of the original hydrology, chemistry, biology that are in a living, intact stream.
I came here last summer, and the first, I think the second day I was here, I was at a community member's house, and he, within the first few minutes, brought out this yearbook from high school and was showing us all of the people who had cancer and are either still living with cancer or who had died from cancer. And the number, just like the sheer number of people, was just appalling. And the folks that he said that weren't sick, that didn't have cancer, that hadn't died, were folks who didn't drink the water, who specifically did not drink the water.
You know, coming here and starting to pull data from Freedom of Information Act requests, looking at DMRs, which are direct monitoring reports, which are documents that the coal companies themselves put together, even in their record keeping, you're seeing levels of selenium, manganese, other toxins in public drinking water supplies that in other parts of the country and in other parts of the developed world, nobody would stand for. And because it's happening here, and it's happening to poor communities and rural communities, and because it's happening in a way that allows certain people to profit incredibly, because of those three things, it can happen here, and it's invisible.
There's no question about what it is. It's not, this isn't happening in other places, and this is the reason that people are dying in such large numbers is because people are being poisoned, and there are no other.
I originally came here as a grad student to do research for a master's thesis. Somebody in my position writing reports and doing research in an environment where the regulatory agencies are as captured and corrupt as they are down here, doing that research and writing those reports also needs to be coupled with a strong, public, loud, unified, rowdy, direct action campaign, because good science alone in the hands of corrupt or inept people doesn't do anything. So I'm going to be providing direct support to good friends of mine who are going up into trees on the Slip Ridge mining permit in Raleigh County, West Virginia, down here in the coal fields.
When folks are up in the trees, then the company is not allowed to let up a blast within 300 feet of that the protected structure.
This direct action is a tree set that I will be up in alongside someone else, and it'll be near a high wall miner, and it will be ending, it will be stopping work from happening. And I'm realizing, I think more and more, that it is a dangerous thing to take, but what the coal industry is doing here is infinitely more dangerous, and I think the risks that we're taking need to be taken to end what is being done here.
It's definitely dangerous, and honestly it is a little bit scary to me when I'm up there and I realize that there are a couple small ropes and carabiners keeping me from falling 80 feet. I don't take that lightly. It's worth it to take this risk is because I recognize that there is so much at stake. I know that people's lives are at stake, and I know that the peculiar beauty of this region and its biodiversity and the many species that live here are at stake also.
On the 26th of July, environmental activist Tim DeChristopher was sentenced to 2 years in prison and a $10,000 fine for doing nothing more than bidding against oil and gas companies on a last-minute George W. Bush land auction to so-called open up Western lands for destruction by oil and gas companies. The bids he placed, 13 in all, disrupted the auction, caused it to be invalidated, and by the time things were straightened out, President Barack Obama was in office and the oil and gas leases were canceled, so the action was successful. Now the courts want their pound of flesh. On the 26th of July, protesters gathered outside federal courthouses in D.C., in Ohio, in about 20 cities in all, and there was a massive protest outside the Salt Lake City courthouse where Tim DeChristopher was sentenced, where he gave this speech.
The world wanted to see how you would react. And you all have reacted with joy and resolve. You've shown that your power will not be intimidated by any power that they have. And that's the most important thing that has happened here this week. Because everything that went on inside that building tried to convince me that I was alone and that I was weak. They tried to convince me that I was like a little finger out there on my own that could easily be broken. And all of you out here were the reminder for all of us that I wasn't just a finger all alone in there, but that I was connected to a hand with many fingers that could unite as one fist. And that fist could not be broken by the power that they have in there. That fist is not a symbol of violence. That fist is a symbol that we will not be misled into thinking we are alone. We will not be lied to and told we are weak. We will not be divided, and we will not back down. That fist is a symbol that we are connected and that we are powerful. It's a symbol that we hold true to our vision of a healthy and just world, and we are building the self-empowering movement to make it happen. All those authorities in there wanted me to think like a finger, but our children are calling to us to think like a fist. And we know that now I'll have to go to prison. We know that now that's the reality, but that's just the job that I have to do. That's the role that I face, and many before me have gone to jail for justice, and if we're going to achieve our vision, many after me will have to join me as well. Nobody ever told us that this battle would be easy. Nobody ever told us that we wouldn't have to make sacrifices. We knew that when we started this fight. Every wave on the ocean that has ever risen up and refused to lay back down has been dashed upon the shore. But it's the very purpose of a wave to rise up. Because once it rises above the horizon, it finally has the perspective to see that it's not just a wave, that it's a part of a mighty ocean. And the sharpest rock on the wildest shore can never break that ocean apart. They can never wear that ocean down. Because it's the ocean that shapes the shore. And that's what we're starting to do here today. That's what we're starting to do here this week. With wave after wave after wave crashing against that shore, we shape it to our vision. Thank you all for being a part of that.
As President Obama and Congress engage in a sometimes nasty public debate on negotiating a legislative resolution to raising the nation's debt ceiling before an August 2nd deadline, the politics of the 2012 election is never far away. Competing policies on addressing national debt, the solvency of Social Security and Medicare, and future tax rates will all be important issues in the presidential and congressional election in November 2012. But as the U.S. corporate media focus their attention on the Democratic-Republican Party debate in Washington, the election campaign has taken an ugly turn in state capitals around the country. Republican governors working with GOP-controlled state legislatures have passed dozens of bills designed to place obstacles in the path of minority, senior citizen, and student voters to cast ballots in the upcoming election. Republican legislative measures, which many critics charge have been enacted to gain partisan political advantage over Democrats, include severe limitations placed on voter registration drives, restrictive photo ID laws, curtailing opportunities for early and absentee voting, and efforts to disenfranchise college students. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Wendy Weiser, director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. She discusses new election voting laws being implemented in various states, their impact on election participation, and efforts underway to challenge these tactics to suppress the vote.
We have seen a real significant assault on voting across the country, the most significant assault we've seen in decades. We are seeing a range of bills and laws passing across the country that make it a lot harder for people to register and to vote and to participate effectively in our democracy. They come in all different sorts of flavors. One common is very restrictive voter identification requirements, or requirements that people prove their citizenship with certain documentation. There are also laws that make it harder to register, that cut back on early voting, that add certain technical barriers to voting or to having your vote counted. It's been a real broad-based attack on voting, and it will have a significant impact, we believe, in 2012 and going forward.
Can you talk maybe about some of the individual states that many of us have been reading about in Wisconsin, Florida, Georgia, and some others?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to do so. One, Florida is a really good example of a state that has just passed a very restrictive set of measures on voting. Florida passed a significant bill that will make it much more difficult for individuals to register to vote. They have essentially made it impossible for voter registration drives to operate in that state, and they've also made it more difficult for registered voters to change their address and still be able to vote a ballot that will count. That's very significant. Both of those are very significant because the rate of voter registration in Florida has been declining significantly over the past number of years, and so this we're going to expect to see it decline even further. They've also reduced early voting. That was a very significant development and positive development in Florida law that many minority voters, for example, took advantage of in 2008 and in 2010, and now the number of early voting days has been cut back significantly. So that's one example of a set of restrictions that passed. Wisconsin passed an extraordinarily restrictive voter ID law, now perhaps the most restrictive law in the country, that has a very limited set of photo identifications that can be used for voting and doesn't have a lot of options for people who don't have those IDs on them on election day to be able to cast a ballot that will count, and doesn't make it very easy for people to get those IDs if they don't have them.
Wendy, the rationale for many of these laws being implemented across the country by these Republican governors in the Republican-dominated state legislatures, the rationale is that there's a lot of voter fraud out there, that many people are voting fraudulently under false names, that somehow that this fraud is changing the results of elections, so therefore these state governments have to crack down. Is there any evidence that there is a plague, a virtual kind of outbreak of voter fraud around the country that rationalizes this action?
Absolutely not. In fact, to the contrary. Now, to be clear, there are election irregularities and there is some fraud in election, but it is not the kind of fraud that these laws are targeting. Study after study show that individuals showing up at the polls and fraudulently voting and trying to be someone else is just something that does not happen. There have been substantial investigations of elections in a number of states, statewide investigations in Washington State and Ohio, for example, that have shown that the rate of in-person voter fraud is really infinitesimal, that you are much more likely to get struck by lightning than to have an American try and commit this kind of in-person voter fraud.
Wendy, what are the ways in which civil liberties advocates and people who are trying to make it possible for as many citizens to vote as possible who are opposed to these laws, what tools do they have to challenge these state laws under federal jurisdiction, the courts, or however it would be effective? What can they do?
The Department of Justice or federal courts applying the Voting Rights Act of 1965 might play a role. And in a number of states, largely in the South, but not exclusively, that are covered by the Voting Rights Act, the Department of Justice or a federal court has to pre-clear the law. It cannot go into effect until either Department of Justice or a court decides that the law is not going to have a negative impact on minorities and their ability to participate in elections and elect their representatives of their choice. And a number of states that have passed these laws are subject to that requirement, and right now some of these have already been submitted to the Department of Justice for consideration, like Florida, like North Carolina will be as well, Texas, That's one tool that is available to people in the courts. Certainly, the U.S. Constitution and our state constitutions are another tool. We do have a right to vote that is protected under the constitutions of every state and of the United States as well. And if this unduly restricts the right to vote and if people cannot participate effectively, then they might be able to use the federal courts or the state courts as well. People should actually take this assault on voting rights as a rallying cry and say, we will not be discouraged. We will just work that much harder to participate and to mobilize our fellow community members to participate so that nobody takes away our right to vote and our ability to elect the representatives of our choice. So we certainly hope that your listeners take away that message and get energized by this.
That was Wendy Weiser, director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. Learn more about legislation designed to suppress the vote at our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Over the July 16th weekend, members of Respect DC invaded a Walmart in Laurel with drums, horns, and even a tuba. Singers demanded that Walmart respect DC while holding yellow smiley faces backed by an entire brass band. The whole group was able to enter the store and carry out their mission with no effective opposition from befuddled store security. The music you hear is recorded in the protest itself. The protesters were demanding living wages, labor rights, and realistic pensions and health care plans as a condition of Walmart's plans to build any stores in D.C.
The new Walmart's coming. Georgia Avenue, uptown, ain't that something? Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping. Cause they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping. You can't compete with a superstore who's an importer of slave laborers. Craftsmanship, low price to flip to undercut the market. Hand over fist.
Walmart
is infamous for the way they behave. Low wage pay, treat the workers like slaves. Employees who try to use soon find themselves in unemployment lines. The way they treat women needs improving. 1.6 million sisters are suing them for being paid less than the male equivalent. On these issues and more, we can't afford to be ignorant.
Keep DC Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists stop to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
This is the Funkinest Journalist with your three Walmart commandments. Step one, move in and crush competition by underselling. Step two, pay workers nothing and block unionization. Step three, take all that money, put it into the Walton Family Foundation, and turn that into political influence to protect yourself and make even more.
Walmart,
it's not a good fit for Chocolate City. Let me holler black at you with the skinny. Important that you clearly understand and remember DC doesn't work with the right-wing agenda. The Walton families are big contributors to bigoted representatives and senators. Trent Lott, sinister, Strom Thurmond, similar, Confederate, state-loving George Bush ministers. Oversee your plantation mentality, results in black and brown casualties. Statehood opposition for the district has been supported by Walmart's mischief. The D.C. Voting Rights Act was defeated, assisted via Walmart PACs, and now they want to come here to see their money stack. Stay up on the facts. Chocolate City, don't relax and fight back.
Keep D.C. Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists stop to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
Keep DC
Walmart Free is an emerging activist group of D.C. residents stepping up to challenge the corporate big box invasion of Chocolate City. Walmart has plans to establish 4 stores in D.C. by 2012. Walmarts in D.C. will threaten small businesses, cause loss of more jobs than it will bring to the community, and lower the wage standards for all workers. To find out more and get involved, visit WalmartFreeDC.org.
In Montgomery County, Maryland, upscale developers in Silver Spring are complaining to the police about young people under 18 hanging out. Due to curfews in D.C. and PG County, and maybe police harassment at Gallery Place, Silver Spring has become one of the few places people under 18 or young-looking without ID documents can hang out without fear of arrest. Apparently, the wealthy owners of Silver Spring's fancy new buildings don't like that very much. Everyone wants to make sure they don't have teenagers, it seems. At the request of the police, county executive, and no doubt developers, Montgomery County Council member Valerie Irvin, who represents Silver Spring, has introduced curfew legislation similar to D.C.'s law, which D.C. cannot effectively enforce. Councilmember Mark Elrich, to his credit, is saying the idea needs further study, a way of blunting the momentum and putting it on the back burner. The complaints from business owners center on teens in general, yet they say this law is needed to prevent gangs from coming to Silver Spring in the future. This, in turn, means the real target of the law is young people of color, especially Montgomery County's Latino community. Out of fear of gangs that are not even going to Silver Spring, the police and developers want to see young people, and especially young people of color, swept off the streets by armed police in all of Montgomery County, even places 20 miles from Silver Spring. They've gone so far as to propose that Rockville and Gaithersburg, where the proposed county law could not apply, would have to pass curfews too, for fear of becoming curfew-free zones. What have we come to when rich suit and tie developers have the power to order police with guns to arrest or detain people simply for being under 18 and out at night? Don't they understand that just one negative encounter with the police is enough to turn many young people into permanent enemies of all law enforcement and all of the people who stand behind it? Don't they understand that the real gangs, including MS-13 and even a few jihadi groups, recruit in the very prisons they send people to? In Iraq and Afghanistan, when people are treated as insurgents, many of them decide to become insurgents. That was how the resistance in occupied Iraq grew. It began with a few former members of the government attacking U.S. troops, especially after an incident involving a U.S. helicopter, a flag on a mosque, and police aggression against the crowd. Soon the attacks mushroomed, and the U.S. responded with a policing model of raiding people's homes. Many of those raided decided to become insurgents themselves, and within months the war mushroomed. Less than a year later, those 4 Blackwater thugs were strung from that famous bridge in Fallujah, and it was on!